This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
So you have a podcast, and you really want to make money with it. Then you need the Odyssey Creator Lab. Check this out. We'll host your podcast for free. You just do your show. We'll use the power of Odyssey's massive expert sales team to place ads in your show and make you money. Does it get any easier than that? Nope. You stay in control of your show, and we help you bring in the money. Sounds like a dream partnership. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and start earning more from your content today.
And rolling on into the final hour of Sports Talk. Jeff Nowak here filling in for Steve Geller. Got Charlie Long running all the knobs I don't really understand behind the glass over there. We're taking you up till 8 p.m. We're going to have a lot of talk about NBA playoffs. We're going to have some more weather updates on the severe storms rolling into Louisiana. But first, we got to get into the NBA playoffs, and no one better to do that with than Will Guillory, NBA and Pelicans writer for The Athletic. You know, Donovan Mitchell is currently out there doing mean things to Pascal Siakam. Maybe trying to prove a point. Will, how have you been enjoying the NBA playoffs to this point?
Man, I've been enjoying it. I'm glad y'all didn't call me like 5 minutes ago because I was just screaming at the TV after what Donovan Mitchell just did against Pascal Siakam. Man, it's just been a really fun playoffs, a lot of really tough physical games, crazy endings in the fourth quarter. I think it's just been a really great couple of weeks for the NBA all around.
Yeah, you know, I wish you could always just fast forward to the first round into these, because this is when the matchups really start to get exciting, at least in my opinion. You know, obviously the 5-4, the 6-3, there's something there. But once you get to the 4-1, you know, that's where the kind of noise really starts. And we've seen it, right? The first three series started with the lower seeded team stealing home court. The Warriors still have a chance to do that tonight when they face off with the Timberwolves. I am curious, you know, of the three teams of the Celtics, the Cavs, and the Thunder that lost game one at home, which one would you say, you know, if you had to pick one that should be the most on upset alert, which one would it be and why?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm going to kind of contradict myself when I say this because I am that one of the big believers in OKC and their ability to not just win the West, but to win it all this year. But I think you have to put them high on the list just because, you know, they're a young team that hasn't done it, right? And until you kind of get those battle scars, until you go through these games and complete those fourth quarters and get those wins, it's still very tough to look past like a Boston Celtics that just won the championship last year. We know what those guys are capable of. We've seen them have, you know, tough losses at home in the playoffs and bounce back. And I think this is going to be a big opportunity for OKC to show that they can really do it and kind of deal with that and execute. And I think the big thing for them moving forward is just getting other guys outside of Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. I think Jalen Williams had a really tough game. Obviously, Chet Holmgren missed the two free throws at the end. But I think for that young squad, they got to get some of those other guys involved. They got to have really big nights and not lean as much on SGA.
You know, it's a great point, Will. And Jeff and I were talking about this last hour, that this OKC team has just kind of rolled through the season. I mean, you go 68-14. If you include the sweep against Memphis, it's now 72-14. And they've finally gotten punched in the face by this Denver team. And Nikola Jokic, who just, I don't know how you feel about the MVP race. I just continue to get proven right that he's the best player in basketball, the best player in the world. He's unbelievable every single night. And it feels like it's going to be interesting to see how this OKC team responds to adversity, because they really haven't faced it at all this year. They've just kind of rolled throughout the season and just destroyed Memphis in the first round of the postseason. And now Denver comes away in a huge comeback in game one and really steals game one from them.
Right, and I think a big thing you saw in the first game is just going to be execution late in fourth quarters, right? Because we know Jokic is just the best in the league. Late in games, he's able to get whatever shot he wants all the time. He can get rebounds. He makes free throws. He hit a huge three late in that game, in game one. So we know what he can do late in games. But, will OKC be able to consistently get shots if it's not Shai Gilgeous-Alexander? How many of those other guys are going to be able to step up and help? It's going to be a huge storyline. I think also they just had a couple tactical errors, I thought, in that first game. I thought it was confusing kind of having Chet Holmgren on Nikola Jokic the whole time. He was just getting bodied down there in the paint. I think there are a couple things they can switch up just to give Jokic some different looks, make it a little more difficult on him. But, I mean, like you said, he's the best in the world. He's going to find a way to make it work. It's just about OKC kind of overpowering them with the numbers because that's what they've done all season.
You know, Will, I'm curious on your take on Donovan Mitchell, a guy who's obviously playing right now. It's halftime. They're up by 11. You know, to me, he's always kind of reminded me of Dwayne Wade, with the major exception being, you know, Dwayne Wade early in his career had that run with Shaq, won a championship, and kind of got that monkey off his back early. And so no one really talked about, like, does he have enough to win? Whereas Donovan Mitchell, I think he's been in the playoffs every year of his career. He's always been kind of this elite playoff scorer. He's never been to a conference finals. And, you know, I watch this guy and it's like he's got all the tools. He's got all the athleticism. He can play deep. He can play both ways. But, you know, he just can't seem to get over the hump. And it's what I would have said about the Celtics duo a couple years back before, you know, they obviously went to the finals with Ime Udoka. They got over the hump last year and won a title. Like, where do you land on Donovan Mitchell? Where would you put him among, like, the premium NBA scorers, winners, as it relates to just playoff success?
Well, I think you're 100% right. I think he's one of the most interesting characters in this playoffs, because I think naturally a lot of our attention goes to the younger guys, like Anthony Edwards or Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, or the older guys like LeBron or Steph Curry. And you know, we kind of just assume that, you know, Donovan Mitchell is going to be the guy who has the great regular season and goes out in the second round. But you know, this year I had him fifth on my All-NBA ballot. I had him also fifth on the MVP ballot. I thought he was outstanding this year, not because, like you said, we've seen him have those huge 40, 50-point games. But I think the real change, which you saw in Cleveland this year, was the way they played as a unit. They played together this season. I think he did such a great job building up those guys around him, and you saw Evan Mobley had the best year of his career. Darius Garland had the best year of his career, and I think a big part of that was Donovan Mitchell and kind of what he did quietly night to night, you know, lifting that team up. And I think that's going to be the big thing for Cleveland now, you know, as the biggest threat in the East to Boston. Can Donovan, you know, do that, but also be the great scorer that we've seen him be in the past? That's going to be, you know, a really big story in the East, just because it feels like Boston's so inevitable, right? Especially when those guys are healthy. But Cleveland, it just feels like they're quietly just chugging along, assuming they get this win tonight. If they can get those guys healthy and ready for that Eastern Conference Finals, I think that's going to be a great series.
Well, what's your concern level for the Celtics? I know that Jeff is a big Celtics fan, so I wanted to throw this at you because, you know, they're up by 20 last night, and then Jalen Brunson, and the shots just aren't going down. The second half, you know, Jalen Brunson and the Knicks go on this crazy run. They very easily could have won it in regulation. Brunson's just floater was a little bit too much under it. But then you go into overtime, and they make all the biggest plays down the stretch. And so the Knicks steal game one from TD Garden. Once again, it could have even been one in regulation before even getting to overtime. At the same time, it feels like the Celtics team is not going to miss 45 threes in a single game for the rest of the series, maybe the rest of the postseason in general. I just want to get your thoughts on it, because I saw this, you know, stat as well, that defending champions have not had recent success in getting out of the second round of the playoffs within the last half decade. But this Celtics team just feels a little bit different.
I know, that's the funny thing. Like I said, with Boston, they often feel so inevitable, but also you watch them, and it's just like they're kind of playing with their food. They know they're great. They're just going to make it happen eventually. They're kind of yawning their way through the playoffs. And you know, with a team like New York, man, they're hungry. They're going to try to figure out a way to get these games. But for me, with the story with Boston is always just, are they healthy? You know, is Jrue Holiday out there? Is Porzingis out there? You know, are they able to put their best five out there? If they could put their best five out there, I think they're better than everybody. They've shown it. They've been through the playoffs. But, you know, with Porzingis, it's unpredictable. And you know, with Jrue Holiday, he's dealt with some stuff the past couple weeks. And now Jaylen Brown's fighting through the knee. So I think, you know, we already see Cleveland, you know, dealing with some injuries now, unfortunately, on the other side of the bracket. But for me, it's always, if Boston's healthy, I can't see anybody beating them. But if not, it's going to be tough.
you know, well, I can't let you off the hook without at least one Pelicans question. You know, we went through the season. We took the medicine of the 21-win season. Well, we get the prize. We get the carrot next week in the draft lottery. The Pelicans had the fourth worst record, so I think they have a 12-something-odd% chance of 12.5% chance of landing the number one pick. And so my question is a little more nuanced than what would you do with the number one pick. My question is, if you're the Pelicans, and you obviously have Joe Dumars leading the ship now. Looks like a lot of the staff is going to stay in place. There have been some changes, but if you did land the number one pick, does that significantly change how you approach this offseason in terms of maybe some trades you would make, how you would structure your roster, knowing that, got to be Cooper Flagg, I imagine. I don't see how that's going to change. Compared to if you stuck at four, would those two plans for the offseason in your eyes be very, very different?
I think if you land one, you certainly have to take it more seriously the possibility of trading Zion Williamson, for sure, just because obviously those guys play the same position. But I think, just Cooper Flagg, the whole feeling of him coming to New Orleans, it'll allow you to just have that fresh start. It'll kind of be similar to like when Zion came in, right? And that was as Anthony Davis was on his way out of the building. It just felt like an opportunity to just start anew, right, and just leave all of the past behind you. I'm always consistent in this, that I'm always bet with the talent. I would love to see Cooper Flagg and Zion play together. I think that would be pretty fun. But I think, yeah, of course you got to at least consider it more if you land at one with Cooper Flagg. But I think at four, you definitely would just feel more comfortable keeping Zion if you're just not worried as much about the off-court stuff. If they land number one, the talk that entire night is like, where is Zion Williamson going next, right? What's the next step for Zion? And I think if you're the Pelicans, you definitely got to consider it, just because I think Cooper Flagg is that special of a prospect, and he can be a guy that's the face of your franchise.
Yeah, well, he's the gold chipper of this draft. And so I want to actually get your thoughts, because it's basically a coin flip if the Pelicans are going to land in the top four. I think it's like a 48.1% chance when you combine all the numbers that they'll get a top four pick. And then the lowest they can fall is eight, but getting the eighth pick is so minuscule. It's like a 2% chance that they fall that far. So first and foremost, I want to get your thoughts, because Flagg is the top prospect in this class, and he's the unanimous number one guy. The number two guy, I think, has also kind of become a tier of his own in Rutgers' Dylan Harper, the point guard prospect. I want to get your thoughts on him before I ask you about, some of the prospects a little bit further down the board.
Yeah, I agree exactly how you put it. I think Cooper Flagg's in the tier by himself up top, and then I got Dylan Harper right below that, in the tier by himself. He's just a big point guard. I kind of think of him, I always compare him like a lefty Cade Cunningham or a bigger Jalen Brunson, that type of point guard, a guy who can make a whole lot of plays out of pick and roll, can pass, makes big shots at the end of the games. I love Dylan Harper's game. I think he would be an amazing guy to put with the Pelicans, especially considering the DeJounte Murray injury, questions at point guard. If you land that guy, that just answers so many questions for you moving forward.
And then, as I mentioned, Will, it's kind of a coin flip if you get that top four pick. But if they do fall out of the top four and get, say, pick five, I know their highest percent chance technically by the odds is pick six, which is like 25% chance to get the sixth overall selection. Who are some of those prospects? Because, after Harper, it's like B.J. Edgecombe from Baylor and Ace Bailey are kind of in that next tier. And then it gets a little bit more kind of questionable from five to, let's say eight. So I want to get your thoughts on some of those other prospects if the Pelicans don't get lucky and land a top four pick.
Yeah, in my mind, I think Edgecombe is for sure number four. I've talked to some people who consider him number three right now on their board. But I think if you go beyond the top four, if you know me, this hurts my soul to say this because I'm a North Carolina fan, but I think Con Kanepo, I think the wing or guard, however you want to call him, from Duke, just brings so much as a shooter, a guy who can make plays off the dribble. I think he's just a rock-solid guy you could take at five and just know what you're getting from him. And I'm also a big fan of Trey Johnson, the young guard out of Texas, average 20 a game, just a real gunner, can get you, 20, 30 on any given night with the way he shoots the ball. I really like those two guys at five. But I think that the great thing about this draft is there are a lot of options between five and 10. There are a lot of good players, throughout that top 10. So you got to feel pretty good as long as you stick somewhere in that 4, 5, 6 range.
All right. Will Guillory, NBA and Pelicans writer for The Athletic. Appreciate you taking the time, and make sure to enjoy these playoff games.
Absolutely, man. Appreciate you guys.
Thanks, Will.
All right. Again, I'm Jeff Nowak. He's Charlie Long. We're taking you up till 8 p.m. Got some interesting Saints updates. We got some Derek Carr news, which, it always kind of makes some waves. Jane Slater, the NFL Network, with some interesting reporting. We'll get into some of that the rest of the hour. We're also going to hear from Colin Arnold, Homeland Security Director for New Orleans. Give us an update on the pumping situation as some severe rain, some severe weather heads into South Louisiana. As I look over my shoulder, doesn't seem like we're getting hit by any of that yet, but should be rolling in relatively soon. So we'll get into all of that. Again, Jeff Nowak, Charlie Long. This is WWL. Stick around. And we're back here on WWL. Jeff Nowak, Charlie Long, taking you up till 8 p.m. We're going to go over to the Oakland Heart Jewelers talking text line, get more into this severe weather threat the New Orleans and South Louisiana are looking at over the next few days. We're going to bring in Connellan Arnold, Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Preparedness for New Orleans. Colin, thanks so much for the time. How are you doing this evening?
Hey, how you doing, Jeff?
Good, good, good. You know, so why don't you give us the rundown? You know, what is the city kind of expecting? What are we preparing for over the next few days from a pumps perspective, from a flooding perspective?
Yeah, so fortunately right now, a lot of this is going to the north for the city. But, I mean, obviously neighbors in from Baton Rouge to the North Shore should be very aware right now because there's a lot of weather, you know, that's started to come through that area. But behind what we're seeing right now on the North Shore is a larger kind of tail that's swinging all the way down through Texas. And I think more so tonight, overnight, and tomorrow morning, you know, they're calling for anywhere from 4 to 6 inches of rain through Thursday, but localized rain could go up to 10 inches, according to the Weather Service. So, you know, that all depends on whether we get that, you know, 4 to 6 inches in 2 hours or over the course of a day and a half. I think we can handle it. It's when it, you know, all comes within an hour or two that we start to have issues because it overwhelms the system. You know, I spoke with Sewage and Water Board. Obviously, you know, both in Jefferson Parish and in Orleans, they've been talking about, you know, trying to catch up with some of this, you know, catch basin cleaning. If you can manage that, just to help out by looking in your neighborhood around your residence, and if you have any debris just on the outside of the grill or the grates of that catch basin, that certainly can help with making sure that the water can drain. If it's something larger in Orleans, we certainly encourage you to call 311 and get DPW to get a vacuum truck out, or excuse me, Sewage and Water Board to get a vacuum truck out there, because they are now cleaning catch basins, and they've had trucks on duty throughout this. They have 88 of 93 pumps working. It appears that the most of the pumps, so there's one on the West Bank in Algiers, but the majority of those that are out are in New Orleans East. They do have, you know, each station has more than one pump, and some of those that are technically down on their list are available for emergency use. I know that they've been pumping down canals, you know, pretty rigorously because we've had some notice on this at least a day and a half. We've kind of seen this coming, and so they've been pumping down the canals so they can take in a lot more water from the streets. But again, this is one of those situations where, you know, if we get enough rain over a short period of time tomorrow and into Thursday, you know, we could have some street flooding issues. And so it's always wise to, when, you know, in these rainstorms, if you can avoid being on the roads, that's the best thing. But if you are on the roads, just to be, you know, extra careful, particularly around areas that tend to collect water, like, you know, underpass locations. There's 12 of them around the city. We do have them marked with signs and flashing lights when the water gets, you know, above 4 inches at the bottom of those, which is certainly advisable to not drive under those, you know. And we'll also send out NOPD or the fire department, whoever can get there first, to actually put out barricades to block those streets. So that's kind of where we're at right now. We've got our team here in the office monitoring this, and we're just going to continue to, you know, if we have to make some decisions about any type of, you know, alterations to scheduling for government employees or for schools, we're going to do that. And then we've also lifted neutral ground parking restrictions through Thursday at 7 p.m. So, you know, if you can get your car and park your car overnight tonight on higher ground, just to make sure in case rain comes through overnight tonight, that's going to be the best thing.
Yeah, you got through a lot there. You know, obviously we're heading into hurricane season, you know, and starts June 1st. But you know, how is kind of the feeling around the pumping system at this point? I know you said 88 of 93 available. You know, in, I know power generation is always a question that comes into that conversation. Where are we from that perspective? I know there's a new substation that should be online in the next few months.
Telling you, I'm excited about that. You know, I'm waiting for it. And I think they're, you know, I've talked with Energy, I've talked with Sewage and Water Board, they're on track. And I'd really like to see that for June 1st. You know, obviously the historical start of hurricane season, but definitely when we're starting to get into the dog days of August and September and October, I want that new power station to be up and running, and I'm really looking forward to that, because what that's going to do is you know to have a direct line, a hardened, resilient direct feeder into that Carrollton water plant is going to be a game changer for how power is managed around the system. And to your point, the power is usually the issue. When we say 88 of 93 pumps and those types of things, obviously we want 93 of 93, but stuff happens. Pumps go down. They require a lot of maintenance. And so there's a little bit of redundancy in that system as far as like every pump station has multiple pumps that can work. And so, you know, obviously I want to see as many of those working as possible, but what really I think drives the issues that we have and that we've had in the past is the power situation. When commercial power gets lost and we have to rely on the, you know, turbines and diesel generators and those types of things to run the system. So this new West Power Complex is going to be a huge benefit for the city, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, I'm as big a history buff as the next guy, but not when it comes to you know, power generators from the 1900s, right?
Right, right.
All right, thanks so much, Colin Arnold, Director of Homeland Security and Preparedness, getting us ready for the severe
and
weather.
Just say, and I always remind people, ready.nola.gov. We also have our NOLA Ready app that you can get on both iOS and Android, that has the Sewage and Water Board's pump dashboard and energy outages, everything all on one app. And then you can also sign up for alerts by texting NOLA Ready, one word, to 77295, and we'll be updating throughout this event.
You heard it there, ready.nola.gov. Colin Arnold, Director of Homeland Security and Preparedness for the City of New Orleans. Thanks so much for the time. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Jeff.
All right, again, we got severe weather rolling into the area starting tonight. Neutral ground parking restrictions have been lifted, so if you're worried about your car, make sure to go get it on some elevated ground before that rain starts rolling in through South Louisiana. I'm Jeff Nowak. He's Charlie Long, kicking you up till 8 p.m. on Sports Talk. This is WWL. Coming back in on WWL, Jeff Nowak, Charlie Long, kicking you up till 8 p.m. on Sports Talk, WWL, AMFM.com, and the Odyssey app. And Charlie, we have some, I don't want to call it breaking news because I wouldn't say it's breaking news. We have some news about Derek Carr, which is news in and of itself, because this offseason has been basically radio silence other than a sermon out in Las Vegas and, you know, kind of not been seen. But Jane Slater of NFL Network had some updates that she just shared out regarding Derek Carr, one being that he has been in New Orleans, met with a team doctor at least twice in recent, or he's been in New Orleans at least twice in recent weeks, met with a team doctor. So they're trying to figure out a path forward with this shoulder injury. She also reported, you know, the timeline of it all kind of goes to what David Carr actually said on a pre-draft NFL Network show, that Derek believes that his injury came during that same game against the Giants where he did that running Superman leap, fractured his hand, and believes that injury happened there as well. The reason he didn't know about it until later into the offseason is because that was when he started ramping up to really throw, started to push that shoulder, and that's where he felt it. The timeline still seems kind of weird, considering all we heard about toward the end of the season was that he was getting ready to come back, but sounds like, based on Jane Slater's report, that, you know, that was kind of minimal throwing off to the side with, you know, not a real football and some rehab stuff. You know, and otherwise it's just, hey, the Saints and Derek Carr are going to try to figure out the best path forward, whether that involves surgery, whether that involves rehabbing without surgery. That remains to be seen. OTAs are going to start next month or later this month. Actually, you know, the next month you have a rookie minicamp coming up. And so we'll see. Is he going to be there? Derek has been at OTAs prior to this. Will he be there working off to the side? Will he be in attendance at all? We don't know. He will have to be at minicamp, which will be mid-June. And then you'll have about a month break before you come back for the actual training camp. And will he be there? So, I mean, that's become the question of the offseason is, do you go into training camp feeling like we have a veteran bridge option at quarterback alongside our second-round rookie in Tyler Shuck, last year's fifth-round pick in Spencer Rattler, and a draft pick from the year before that in Jake Haener? Or is your quarterback room three young quarterbacks, a rookie, a second-year player, and a third-year player, all battling it out to start on day one on a team that is expected to not be ready to compete right away? Would you rather have Derek Carr in that scenario? Probably. But will he be available? I don't know. So, you know, that's where we are, is it's kind of a waiting game, and the next major news that you're going to get about Derek Carr is likely going to be, has decided to have surgery, A, or B, has decided to try to rehab without surgery.
Right. And the two biggest things that I see at the bottom here are this Jane Slater tweet, which is quite lengthy. Why not get surgery? And she says that he would rather try to rehab it without getting surgery, but if surgery is necessary, then he'll have to go through that. At the same time, another thing that she added here as well, that a decision either way will be made here sooner rather than later, per that same source. So we should be getting an update, hopefully very soon, about whether or not he actually got the surgery. And then we expect the timeline will kind of shift depending on if he gets it or not.
Yeah, because here's the thing. If you're Derek Carr, you know, the reason you get surgery in this case is probably going to be because the doctor says, hey, you could try to play through this, but getting surgery will prolong your career by X number of years, whereas playing through it, you know, you may never get back to the level you want to be at. So that's probably going to be the decision Derek needs to make. It's also a scenario where you're late enough in the offseason now that you're going to be gone next season regardless. It's like Tommy John surgery. You basically erase that season.
Right.
But you also still want to make sure you get it done early enough that you can rehab and be ready for 2026. So it's not affecting you then. So I think that's kind of, you're not going to want to wait and wait and wait until the end of training camp and then get it done.
I need to get a button bar here, Jeff, that just plays like soap opera music, like dramatic music. Anytime
we
bring
up,
exactly. Every time we bring up Derek Carr, I'll play that music and it'll be kind of playing underneath us talking about the continuing soap opera of Derek Carr.
I could record something for you now. Just go dun dun dun, you know, something dramatic.
Yeah, turn it over quickly.
I'll work on it during the break, and we'll see what we can come back with. But all right, we're gonna hit one final break here. Come back, talk more about LSU baseball. We got some sound from Jay Johnson talking about the upcoming final two series for Tigers baseball, what that could mean. Hey, no more classes. That helps, right? We'll get into that and more. Closing it out until 8 p.m. here on Sports Talk. Jeff Nowak, Charlie Long. Keep it locked on WWL. All right, getting ready to close things out here on WWL. We won't see LSU baseball back in the field until Friday, but we do have Jay Johnson talking about the final two weekend series heading into the SEC tournament. Charlie, hit it.
Again, you've got back-to-back weekends now. I know the final weekend of the regular season will be a Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, as it always is, in preparation for everybody to get to Hoover in the SEC tournament. But these next 2 weeks are Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. The last 2 weeks, Tennessee and now Texas A&M. Do you like that schedule as far as how you can get everybody rested, get your arms ready, not only be able to throw the guys you want and need to throw on a given midweek, and then still be ready for the back end on the week?
Are you talking about in Hoover or
no? For the last 2 weeks, being Friday through Sunday.
So it was a little unique with the doubleheader. It's part of the reason why I was kind of going like, hey, if there's a window on Friday, let's play on Friday, because now we don't have the flexibility to line it up or change anything that we normally would. So now we'll have back to back weeks where the guys theoretically will go on one less day's rest, which they've already done like three times because, again, everybody wants the Tigers on TV, so we play on Thursday a lot. So this is not a new thing. Obviously, our road to the College World Series is running through Cade Anderson and Anthony Ianson, so we just want to make sure we help those guys get stronger as the year goes along. So we got to pay attention to that a little bit. But that's part of it, and, I think they're – they're two of the best well-conditioned guys on the team, and you know they've gone over 100 pitches three or four times this year and done a great job as they've done it. And like I said, we mainly just want to get those guys to the postseason intact and ready to roll for games one and two of that.
I mentioned earlier in the show that exams for the spring semester is coming up and the school year will officially end. I have to imagine, again, this baseball team being around you and your staff long enough to know that every day and every week, very similar, so they know what to expect every single day. But once the classwork is behind them and it's all baseball, how do things change for you guys as far as not just you and what you ask them to do, but what they're able to do even on their own time?
Yeah, I think I'll just use the word some panic goes out the window of leaving an assignment till the 11th hour and rushing to get it done and submit it online. That's all gone and gone away. And we don't have any academic issues in our program. Zero. Like, the guys do what they're supposed to do and have crushed. Yeah, give my hand for sure. And crush school. Like, this last semester, I think that we had like 35 guys out of the 40 got a 3.0 or better. And I don't anticipate, you know, anything any differently. And they know there's a high standard there. And I think it's important, you know, for a lot of reasons, the degree, your life after baseball, all that, but just the self-discipline. They all came to LSU to play baseball. Like, that's, I do not sugarcoat that. They are here to play baseball, but, and they like going to the field. They like to hit. They like to do that more than they like to go to their chemistry class. If there's a chemistry professor here, I'm sorry to tell you that, but it's important to me that they have discipline in the things that maybe they don't like to do as much. And our guys show that. That's what's expected of them. And they've done a great job. So we have a few more days of that. But then that pressure is off, and then they turn into professional baseball players. And that's a really good time of year to be a player and a really good time of year to be a coach.
Does things change around the building once that schoolwork ends? Or, I mean, as far as, hey, guys, we got this time and you don't have, we're not taking you away from classwork. Let's work on this. I mean, do things change around the building?
Yeah, we may practice or train, as we call it, a little bit earlier in the day, so they get a little more time to recover on the back end. You know, we have some guys that play really demanding positions that play every leverage inning of every game. When you look at Steven Milam, Danny Dickinson, we've had to split the catching thing a lot, which has been great on two fronts. It's getting Cade Arambidi a ton of time. And I, you know, obviously think he's the catcher of the future in the program. It's helped Luis's offense. Like, he really lost his legs in his offense. And, you know, much like I had said earlier, you know, with Ethan Frye, when Luis hits, we are a way better team.
Yeah.
And so, you know, pulling back some of those ABs and some of that catching time has made him a better hitter again. And that really, really helps us and lifts us. So getting those guys as much rest as we possibly can. Derek Curiel, first time going through, you know, the leverage of this season. The relievers, anytime we can get a little extra recovery time for those guys, it really matters, because if you leave it up to their coach, he'd just practice all day and realize that's not always the best thing.
Yeah, it's a closing things out here on Sports Talk. You know, I also appreciate when my classes are over. I can just focus on being a ball player.
The road to the College World Series runs through Cade Anderson and Anthony Ianson. And I think, you know, listen, there's worse double-headed monsters in the college baseball world than those two guys at the top of your rotation. That's part of the reason why you can be very bullish on LSU's postseason chances.
No question. Anytime you get into the College World Series, you need two. Right, you need a 1-2 punch on the mound, or you really don't have much of a shot, especially once you get into the College World Series part of the equation. But all right, Jeff Nowak, Charlie Long, this has been Sports Talk. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Who dat? Keep it locked on WWL.